Hi, I'm Dr. Kat Lewitsky, and welcome to Psych Confidential, where we cover no-nonsense mental health discussions. If this is your first time listening, welcome. If you are a return listener, thank you for joining back. This is episode 3, and today I want to talk about the experience of having an autistic child. This episode is inspired by and dedicated to my childhood friend who is currently in the process of having her son assessed for autism. And if you've been through the process of getting a diagnosis, or maybe you're in it right now, you know the real battle and struggle it is to get some answers. And once you get that diagnosis, a new journey begins. Your mind starts to race. What do you do? And what will happen to your child? A colleague from my graduate school, Dr. Simone Billing, who now works at a private practice in Windsor, Ontario, did her dissertation titled "The Mother's Experience of Receiving a Diagnosis of Autism for Her Child." The study was done in 2017, but the research is still pretty relative, I feel, today. Overall, mothers reported not feeling adequately prepared for the diagnostic process and for how their lives would change afterward. Mothers responded by stating they felt frustrated, sad, anxious, and isolated during the diagnostic process and after receiving the diagnosis. Specifically, they found the process to be unnecessarily complicated. Themes from the study also included conflicting feelings of relief and fear, elevated emotions of depression, anxiety, and loneliness, and in some cases, led to a serious decline in quality of life. 1 week following the diagnosis of their child, 79% of mothers reported clinically significant symptoms of depression. I'm a psychologist and specialize in autism testings from toddlers through adulthood, and having an episode to share from a parent's perspective is important so that other parents don't have to feel alone in the process. I have an amazing guest on the show today, Sharon Tonies, who is a mother of 2 twin boys, one autistic, one not. Last weekend, I met Sharon at the Autism Alliance of Michigan Hero Walk, which is a fundraiser with over 5,000 participants that focuses on benefiting the Autism Alliance of Michigan, which is a nonprofit, and includes an autism resource fair, onstage program, United Community Walk, arts and crafts, and entertainment for all ages. So Sharon, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So I really just want to capture your story. Wherever you want to start today, speaking with you at the Autism Alliance was just very inspirational, which is why I wanted to have you on. So wherever you want to start today, from the beginning, I guess, what's your story?
Sure. I think our story is very typical of a lot of autism families. You know, you have a child, they seem on course, they seem mm-hmm. like they're developing normally, and then one day you see them start falling behind. Was very interesting for my husband and I. We have twin boys, mm-hmm. right? So we had a direct comparison between our sons as to how they were developing when they were toddlers. And then one day, after the age of 2, we started to notice that our son Carter was losing words. He had a handful of words that he was using, and he just would never speak them anymore. And over the course of a month, it was October of 2008, he stopped responding to his name. He stopped making eye contact. Those handful of words, mama, dada, mm-hmm. Kit Kat, gone. And we could just see him going into his own world. And we knew at that moment something was different with him. We went to our pediatrician. We went to an ENT to make sure he didn't have mm-hmm. a hearing issue. We did all the typical steps, but yet we weren't getting any answers. Everyone kept saying, you know what? He's the slower twin. He's mm-hmm. the quiet twin. But a mama's gut is the mom's gut. And we know our kids.
Yeah.
And I knew something was different with him, and I knew something was happening. So I turned into go mode as a mom. And I took him to the school district, Farmington Public Schools, to have him evaluated with their Early Start program. And they confirmed that there was some type of delay, at least a speech delay. And so over the course of the next year or two, it was quite the journey. I mean, we did not want our child to be diagnosed with autism, of course. That's not the path we had hoped for him. However, we wanted answers. And so it's very frustrating and sometimes very lonely because you're going to these appointments and everybody tells you your child's going to be fine. But yet you know they're not developing normally and they're getting further and further behind their peers.
So how old was your son when he was finally diagnosed? Because your twins are 16 now, right?
They are, yeah.
Okay, so this was several years ago that you had the testing done. But what's interesting to me is that the process sounds really similar to what I hear parents coming in every day into my office now. But how old were your boys when they were first, or sorry, your son when he was first diagnosed?
So I started seeing him with different behaviors, like just sensory issues when he was about 15 months.
Okay.
And then I could see him regress starting at about 18 months. That started the journey of all these appointments. But yet we didn't get a formal diagnosis until he was about 4 years old.
Yeah, and that's about the average age that a lot of kids actually get receive their diagnosis. And I mean, I do see some, because I know you told me before that your son is more severe, like a level 3 autism. And sometimes I see those kids now getting diagnosed a little bit sooner. But I do still see some kids who are, a lot of kids, it's around age 4 that they're first coming in. And I hear that same process of them coming in where they have to go to the pediatrician, then they do the ENT. And a lot of parents don't know about the school district getting testing from with early on, which is really important. It's a great resource because they can get services before even age 3, which I'm assuming it's probably what
it's exactly
your son,
what we did.
Yeah, which is really great too. So what's been I guess, like, you know, what type of services did you, you know, after you get that diagnosis, like how did you decide which services to get for your son?
So back then in 2008, we did not have autism insurance reform in place. So everything was out of pocket except for the services you could get through your school system. So he was part of the early on program, and then we got on wait lists. Now back then, there weren't a lot of ABA or applied behavioral analysis programs available in the Metro Detroit area. So it was very frustrating.
And if they were, it was out of pocket, right?
It was 100% out of pocket.
Yeah.
And all you had to do was wait. And it's a very stressful time because everybody preaches early intervention.
Yes.
But yet we could not get into any program except for the little bit of services that we were grateful that we were getting from our school district. So we waited. We were on a wait list for 2 years for ABA.
So he didn't really even start getting more intensive services. So he was probably about 6.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what about like the process of like getting IEP 504? I mean, I know that's even getting, you have to get reevaluations a lot of times for autism, which a lot of parents don't really know. And they even have to call us and say, well, now my insurance is making me get a reeval. Like, we know autism is neurodevelopmental, but these kids have to get reevaluations or through the district. What's that process been like for you to get services for your kid, to fight for your kid? Because essentially, I mean, you said at the beginning that, you know, a mother knows, right? And so I always tell moms that when they come in, you know your child more than any other doctor, and you're the advocate for your child. You're with your child more than anybody else. So what has that been like for you? You know, just advocating for your child and all those services.
So the reevaluations can be frustrating because there's waiting lists once again, right? More and more children are being diagnosed. One thing with my son, though, he is severely autistic. He is nonverbal. And so when somebody starts to evaluate my son, it's pretty obvious that he hasn't aged out or grown out or developed out of his diagnosis. So once we finally get to the appointment, it hasn't been too hard for us to get cleared for additional services. But I can see if you have a child who is maybe a little bit higher functioning, maybe they're verbal, that it would be a little bit more challenging and you would have to fight a little stronger for services.
Yeah. Where did you, you know, so you started noticing these symptoms of your son early on and noticing the difference between, you know, the two boys because they're twins. How did you finally, I guess, come to get yourself like on that, you know, wait list? That's some of the struggles my friend has had. You know, she's out of state. I told you before we started recording, she's in Florida. So, you know, it's, I think it's all throughout, you know, our whole, I guess, area that it's hard to get these answers and it's so complicated and you really do get pushed around a lot from person to person to person. How did you finally get to that point of having the autism testing? Like, you got him referred by the school, and then, like, I guess who finally made that evaluation on him and made that diagnosis? Was it like a psychologist?
It was a psychologist. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Through the play project out of Ann Arbor. But okay. We finally went to the MIND, the Michigan Institute for Neurological Disorders.
Okay.
And we had an assessment with a pediatric neurologist. And when he confirmed my fears, he was the first person. And it was almost a blessing because I knew something was off, but everybody kept telling me he was fine. You don't have time to waste when your child's regressing. It's go time. You need to intervene as early as possible for the greatest success overall. And so I said to him, I want you to document everything, and we're going to send it all to the pediatrician. So if you look at his chart at the pediatrician's office, you would think he was a 90-year-old man because he has an extremely thick chart back in the day when they had actual real charts. So I had every assessment, every appointment sent over, just sort of confirm and give the red flag that we have to proceed with something for this child because he is delayed and we don't know the exact diagnosis yet. That came a couple years later, but it's time for him to receive services.
Yeah. I think, you know, just in my experience, because I still hear this story so frequently, it's pretty much like every day in my office. And I think a lot of clinicians and just people in general are just, they're scared to take that step, you know, because, and I mean, I hear all the time where same thing as you, oh, well, they're a boy, they're going to talk later, or, you know, one twin is talking more for the other twin. We might've heard that even, or the older sibling's talking for the younger sibling. And as you know, when you're a mom, you just, you know, you can see it and you know. And I also want to know, too, after you received the diagnosis, then how did you decide to narrow down services? Because you said he was tested with a play project. So play project is like one type of service, play for kids playing language for autistic youngsters. You have ABA therapy. I mean, there's OT, there's PT, there's speech. How did you decide to, I guess, which services would be best for your child? Because that's one of the questions I always get, you know, as a psychologist who does the testing, is they're like, what do I do now? Like, what do I do? And I try to explain to them the services, but how did you decide as a parent? Like, how did you make that decision?
So whether medical professionals like it or not, we all refer to Dr. Google.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so that's a good place I remember to start. After we were, it was confirmed that he was delayed, I stayed up all night Googling. And that was right after the Jenny McCarthy had just been on Oprah. And so it was a lot of information out there about the gluten-free, casein-free diet. And, you know, I got my hands on as many resources as possible and as many, you know, books that I could read. And ABA was always been the gold standard of therapeutic intervention for kids on the spectrum. And so the only problem with us is just we had to wait for those services. So we exhausted what we could get through the school service program. And then we just did little things like, you know, sensory integration. You know, we went through Easter Seals. We went through Judson Center. Any additional therapy that we could get, whether it was OT, speech, therapeutic swimming, therapeutic horseback riding, like over the years, we've done it all. And the majority of it was paid out of pocket, especially those first few years.
What do you think has, I guess, benefited your son most, or what has he been most receptive to? Or maybe is there one that maybe he likes more, is more receptive to? Or is there, I guess, what do you think has been the best, I guess, choice of therapy for him? I know every child's different, but just we're talking particularly with your son.
Hands down, ABA.
Okay.
Because it's individualized and we saw immediate progress. You know, what we learned is that he could learn, he could learn fast, and he could retain that knowledge. So just things by following directions. I mean, the whole, you know, theory around ABA is first you teach them how to learn, right?
Yeah.
And he needed to learn. You know, he needed to learn how to learn, I guess. And once he got that, I mean, the floodgates opened with him making progress and just little things like identifying numbers and colors, things that typical kids learn very easily.
Yeah. And I think that receptive part, too, is that sometimes when we look at these children who are more language delayed and autistic, is that we can also underestimate sometimes what they're even capable of doing or what they're even capable of learning and knowing. And then when you give them those services and that opportunity and you're getting down with them and you're, you know, they're teaching them these skills that you're able, it's quite amazing of how quickly they can learn when they're so adaptive or receptive to a certain type of treatment too. Now, what about with your other son? Because you were a mom here, you have, you know, two young kids, same age, you know, being a twin mom is already stressful enough as it is, right? I mean, that's,
yeah,
it's, you know, I have two kids of my own. They're not twins, but having two kids is difficult. And I've heard even a twin mom, you have two at the same time, everything together. How did you balance that? You know, having more than one child and one child's going to services, like how, you know, I know your son now, he's older, but how did you balance that as a family?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very blessed because my husband has always been very engaged and very hands-on. And I remember him saying when we found out that we were having twins, he said, well, at least they don't outnumber us.
Yeah.
And so together we divided and conquered. I mean, we've never had a lot of family support. His family lives out of the state. My parents are elderly. So we haven't had that family support as much as maybe other families. So we look to hire help, and sometimes it's really hard for me to let go of that control, right? And to find the right care that feels comfortable, you know, taking care of a nonverbal child. You know, a lot of people find, you know, caregivers, babysitters, but a lot of these younger adults are not comfortable with a nonverbal child, right? And some of the behaviors that go along with autism. So it took us several years to find a caregiver who actually was a retired ASD teacher.
Yeah.
So, but that took several years. So it was just my husband and I, and just dividing and conquering everything and getting our kids to where they needed to be.
Yeah. And I know you've been married for 19 years.
Yeah.
And we know that divorce rates are higher in marital conflict for parents who have an autistic child than those who don't. So what is your, I guess, you know, like how have you guys been able to work, you know, handle having two children, one of them being autistic, and be married for almost two decades?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's not always easy.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's, you know, we married later in life. We were financially stable. I mean, we had that going for us. And we were both just committed to making our sons the best they can be, whether they had autism or not. Mm-hmm. And like I said, Brian has always been a wonderful father, very engaged, very hands-on. And we just made sure to make a lot of family time. I remember the first 2 years, I didn't sleep a lot. Mm-hmm. The future waits on you because you don't know what's going to happen to your child. I have a severely autistic child who will need care and supervision his entire life. So I remember the first 2 years not sleeping very much because at night all I would think about was who's going to take care of him.
Yeah.
And so at one point, I couldn't take it anymore. So I was very intentional about saying, okay, this weight on my shoulder, I'm going to take off and I'm going to place it on my nightstand because I cannot control tomorrow and I need to sleep. And so our goal as a family was to make memories, to love our boys, and to make them both the best they could be. And we became very involved in the autism community. I think that's very important for families just to know that they're not alone, that there are other parents going through the same thing, and to educate yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, he's nonverbal. We are his voice.
Yeah.
And if we don't speak up for him, no one will.
You're his advocates.
Yes, absolutely.
And his brother is a huge advocate too, because his brother, I met him as well at the Autism Alliance Hero Walk. He started like a resource page. So tell me a little bit about that. Like, how did he get involved with that? Was it his idea, your idea? And I guess, like, yeah, tell me more about that too.
Yeah. So Chase is the founder of the Awesome Siblings Outreach Project. And so, you know, in school, they already always need community service hours, but we wanted something to be meaningful. So the summer of COVID, we were home a lot, right? And we started to brainstorm about what he could do that would be meaningful. And so he's got a perspective that a lot of kids don't. Mm-hmm. You know, he's had to grow up a little quicker than maybe some of his friends, because, you know, he's very helpful at home with Carter. And he did his first fundraiser in second grade. It was called Dough for Donuts, where he collected money and he brought in donuts for his classroom. And he did a little presentation on what autism is. And so naturally, he's become this advocate without even realizing it. So he's always looked out for his brother. And so it was something that we came, you know, we came up together with as just an opportunity to give back to the community and to provide a service that was meaningful to him. And yet we saw a gap. You know, you Google sibling. I mean, especially
it's
with
COVID. It's a
huge gap.
Huge gap. Yeah.
And then especially with COVID, I mean, a lot of the programs have just sort of gone away. And he has now showcased his project at a couple of autism events, and the responses that he's getting, I mean, mothers crying because they have little boys, right? And they see someone like Chase, who's now 16, who's becoming an advocate. And my son doesn't even fully grasp the impact that he has.
Yeah.
But they're really being inspired, and it's giving people hope. And that's the whole purpose of this.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest things too is that when parents bring their kids in, they get tested and they get the diagnosis of autism. There's this overwhelming stress and pressure of which services do I get, OT, PT, and this is overwhelming, right? They're just trying to just figure out what's going to be the best choice for their child. But one thing I have to constantly reinforce is that you have to take care of yourself as a parent. There's other children in the home. You have to still balance that system, and everybody has to take care of themselves as well too, because you can't fully support your child, your autistic child, and then even your other children in the home, if you're not taking care of yourself as a parent, mental health-wise, physically, emotionally, and then those other children also need support too, though, even the ones who aren't autistic. And that's a huge gap as well, like that parent support, the sibling support. You know, one of the things that I saw that he, on his resource page, is that he was even finding like sibling groups, you know, and these things aren't always there. They are available, but they're far and few between, but they are there. But he found those resources and he's trying to give that information out to people, because he's been through it, you've been through it, and you're just trying to help like that next generation of parents too, who are getting their children diagnosed and assessed and so forth.
Absolutely. And family meetings are important. Family dinners are important. We try to meet once a month as a family and go over our schedules. My husband and I both work full time. All right. My neurotypical son, Chase, he's an athlete. He does travel basketball. That takes us all over the country with that. So there's a lot of planning involved. And I know a lot of other families can relate to that.
Yeah, especially the full-time working. I have a lot of parents actually ask me that. Do I have to quit my job to do this? And you have worked full-time then?
I went part-time for several years.
Okay.
Because, you know, when you get into these ABA programs, you have to take advantage of it. And sometimes the hours do not align well with the work schedule. So on top of paying for it out of pocket, I went to 50%, and I'm very grateful that my employer allowed me to do that for several years. So yeah, it's a lot to balance. And some people have family that can help support them. I was not going to hire a transportation company and have them transport my nonverbal child without me. And I know some families have to do that. It was just something I couldn't do, but we have made it work. And other families can as well. It just takes a lot of planning and a lot of research. So you are aware of what's out there. And the gift of time has given families so many more resources today in 2022. I mean, the Autism Alliance of Michigan has the Navigator program.
Yes.
Super simple. Go online, fill out their form. They can help you with assessment. They can help you with, you know, finding the right ABA program, vocational, everything. We didn't have that. It was just me staying up all night and Googling. There's so much more out there for families that they shouldn't have to feel that they're alone.
Absolutely. Well, I really, truly appreciate you taking the time today to share your story. Are there any last words of encouragement that you can give to parents out there who are either in that process right now? Maybe their child doesn't even have a diagnosis yet. Maybe they just received a diagnosis. Maybe they were diagnosed a few years ago, and maybe they're still just really confused or lost or feeling hopeless or lonely. Like, what are some words of encouragement that you can give families today?
Get involved. You are not alone. Always remember you're your child's voice. So if you don't speak up, no one's going to. And lastly, get out of the house. I know so many families, especially families with children with severe autism, that hide at home because there are difficult behaviors. You have to go through those painful moments. My son, a couple years ago, we went to Alaska. I mean, he's a great traveler.
Yeah.
But I also remember when he was 4 years old and he had a meltdown in the Nashville, you know, airport. But we have gone through those hiccups and has made and stretched him that has made him so flexible. And he follows directions so well that we're in the community all the time doing things. He goes grocery shopping for me every weekend. But it took a lot of negative experiences to get to all these productive moments that we're able to have today. So my guidance is get out of the house.
Yeah, it sounds like you didn't give up. You just kept working with them and working with them.
Yeah. My goal was, we're an autism family and we're going to embrace that. But how can we be the most normal? Mm-hmm. And so that's different for every family, but we've made it over the years work for us. So,
yeah, well, I truly, truly appreciate it. Thank you so much for everyone for listening today. And thank you again, Sharon, just for sharing your wonderful story. I truly appreciate it. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the Psych Confidential podcast, share it with others, or leave a rating and review. You can find more information on my clinic page, which is www.brightpinepsychology.com. And to catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on social media at DrCat_PSYD. I hope you find this information useful, and I wish you all a great week. Until next time, this is Dr. Kat.